Hi, everyone, and welcome to another monthly installment of the Student Press Law Center's podcast, a catch-up on news developments affecting people working in and around the student media. I'm Frank Lamani, Executive Director of the Student Press Law Center. The SPLC is an advocate for the rights of student journalists and the educators who work with them. We're online at splc.org, on Twitter at SPLC, and you can always send your questions about legal issues to us at splc@splc.org. The Student Press Law Center was proud to be a partner with the American Association of University Professors and a number of other free speech and academic freedom organizations in releasing a report on December the 8th titled Threats to the Independence of Student Media. This report was the work of many months of collaboration among the SPLC, the AAUP, and partner organizations invested in promoting free speech on college campuses, and in particular, the well-being of college journalists and journalism educators. My guest on the SPLC podcast to talk about this report, what it means, and where we go from here is Hank Reichman, who is the chair of the Academic Freedom and Tenure Committee at the AAUP. Professor Reichman has a distinguished background as an educator, most recently as a professor in the history department at California State University East Bay, where he has taught since 1989. He's previously taught at Northwestern, at Memphis State, a number of other institutions, in addition to a year spent overseas in Leningrad. He's won numerous awards and recognitions for his excellence in teaching and has served as the chair of the Academic Senate at Cal State East Bay, as well as working with the American Library Association in their freedom of expression work. And so we're especially pleased that the AAUP is an organization, for those unfamiliar, that represents about 57,000 faculty members at campuses around the country, and it is the guardian of academic freedom. It is the keeper of the flame of free speech among faculty on our colleges and universities, and the AAUP often finds itself working in tandem with the SPLC and other organizations to call attention to conditions that threaten the freedom of expression on campuses. We're very happy to have them as a partner in our work. So, Hank Reichman, thanks so much for being with us.
And thank you for having me, Frank.
Well, I want to get started just by talking a little bit about the background that led to the release and the compilation and the release of this report about threats to the independence of student media. The AAUP has actually been quite outspoken about the importance of student journalists and about student rights in general, dating back even to the 1960s. Can you tell us a little bit about the AAUP's investment in student rights and student journalism and why it's important?
Well, of course, the AAUP has ever since our foundation in 1915, has held academic freedom to be a major value of the scholarly profession. And we understand that academic freedom would be meaningless without broader free expression on college and university campuses. In 1967, that understanding led us to join with a number of other groups to release a major statement on the rights and freedoms of students, a statement that I think, as it approaches its 50th anniversary next year, has held up extremely well. And that statement provided in many respects the foundation for our participation in this report, because the statement affirmed the importance of a free student media, and so we were concerned about that. I would add as well that for the AAUP, our concern is not only with student journalists, but as you pointed out earlier, with their educators, because advisors to student media, be they faculty members or staff members, in effect acting as teachers, and in that regard as faculty members, are as vulnerable, in fact, in some ways more vulnerable than students to censorship of their work. Students, of course, are volunteers. They graduate, but faculty members are working at the institution full time, an atmosphere which they can be disciplined for simply carrying out their job and for not censoring student journalists could be very chilling, not only to the student journalists' freedom, but to the overall academic freedom of the faculty as a whole. So this is what led us to participate in this report.
Well, and the report is available both on the AAUP website, which is aaup.org, as well as on the SPLC's splc.org site. We certainly recommend that folks check it out. I'm going to ask you just to summarize it and to talk about what are some of the threats that this report identifies and where are those coming from?
Well, the report, which much of which is based on the excellent work that SPLC has been doing over the years, as well as the College Media Association, which participated in preparing the report, the report has, I'd say basically several major parts. First, it outlines the basic principles, starting with and going back to that 1967 statement on student rights, and then examines a series of representative cases, which the report is strange to stress, are not necessarily by any means the totality of things, which show various kinds of threats to student media, censorship of student media, retaliation against student journalists when they report things that university administrations find uncomfortable or disagree with, and also threats to their advisors as well. We also talk about threats through denial of funding, which is also a major mechanism in which universities use to censor media. And then the report goes on to talk about the legal environment and how unclear and indecisive it is on questions of the First Amendment rights of student journalists in public institutions. And of course, private institutions, student journalists are not necessarily protected by the First Amendment. And then we go on to propose a number of different solutions. I want to point out, though, I think that underlying the entire report is a sense that the threat to student media, while we can't quantify that it's growing, that there is a clear perception that it is. And the report suggests that a major reason for this has been what we in the AAUP like to call the corporatization of colleges and universities, the increasing tendency of university administrators to act as if their institutions were simply businesses and not educational institutions.
I think that's very right, and many of the cases that are enumerated in this report will already be familiar for those who follow news from the SPLC. It highlights situations such as Michael Kelly's case at Fairmont State, where Mr. Kelly became the third media advisor in a row there to be removed under circumstances strongly suggesting retaliation for the editorial content of the newspaper. Subsequently, the editors were disinvited from reapplying for their jobs as editors by a president who told them that she wanted to take the newspaper in a more positive and favorable direction. That's the kind of case that exemplifies what you're talking about, Hank, with institutions being more fixated on a positive public image. I think some of that probably has to do with the erosion of state legislative subsidies for higher education so that these institutions are more dependent on donors than ever before, the competition for the full-pay students who are willing to pay the full freight of tuition to go to these institutions and help subsidize them is also intensifying, and all of those factors combine to make this an especially challenging time to do journalism. You overlay on top of that that it's just a challenging time to do journalism, period. The professional news media industry is not as robust as it used to be. Newsroom employment is down to historic lows, not seen since perhaps the 1970s, if not earlier. And there is just simply less ground cover for those embattled advisors and students when they run crossways with their institution. It used to be the case that a Michael Kelly could count on, that the national news media would come parachuting to his rescue in West Virginia and would make certain that his case was publicized, but we can't necessarily count on that anymore.
One thing to what you were just saying, because I think, I agree with everything you said, of course, but I think it's important to recognize that this pressures on universities to get more money from donors, to appeal to a donor class, should be understood in a particular context. I recently read an excellent book that I highly recommend called The Great Mistake by Christopher Newfield, who teaches in the University of California system. And he argues that, in fact, the willingness of legislators to cut funding for universities is as much fueled by the willingness of universities to raise tuition and to claim that they can provide the same services through tuition increases and increased fundraising from donors. And so it's not simply that the cutting of legislation of state support is the cause. It's also an effect of the growing mentality in university administrators that they can run even public institutions as a business and not look at the broader social and common good produced by the institution. And in that atmosphere, of course, then the concern is increasingly with, you know, having media on the campus that are more like PR organs than they are true efforts in journalism. The irony of this, by the way, is highlighted by another book I recently read by Stefan Collini. I can't remember the title at the moment, but where he points out that the arguments that universities often make to donors are very, and alumni in particular, are very different from the arguments they make to legislators. To alumni, they often talk about the wonderful education and experiences people had, et cetera. To legislators, they say, we can get people jobs on the cheap. You know.
Very much so, yeah. Well, and all of these factors are combining to make institutions more secretive as well as more image conscious. And so you have these dual pressures on newsrooms. Not only are they being coerced either indirectly or even at times directly to portray their institutions in a more favorable light, but also they have more difficulty than they've ever had before just in gaining access to the basic foundational records, meetings, and interviews with newsmakers that they need to keep their communities informed. One of the developing and evolving factors that the report identifies is the increasing tendency of institutions to filter all interactions with employees through a professional public relations image minder. It's now becoming increasingly the standard practice on these campuses that employees can't have unguarded interactions with journalists. And there's certainly a degree of candor and a degree of relationship building and source building that is lost there, and it makes for a less well-informed campus community.
Absolutely, and it is a complete denial not only of the rights of student journalists to probe and to ask questions about the institution they're covering, but against the basic academic freedom of the faculty. Faculty members should be free to comment upon the life of their institution, including making critical comments, including, frankly, making critical comments that are perhaps off the wall and wrong. And they can make them to journalists. They can make them to the public. And if you're telling faculty members you can only talk to a journalist through the mediation of the university's media department or publicity department, then you have a real problem. Faculty members, what about faculty members who regularly write op-eds for newspapers, write about their discipline? Is that going to be now regulated?
I should throw in a mention, by the way, and we have links to these resources on the SPLC website, that there has been some recent authority from the National Labor Relations Board that these kinds of gag orders or orders to say only favorable things about the employer will be viewed as a violation of the National Labor Relations Act if your employer is a private employer governed by the NLRA, which unfortunately excludes public colleges and universities. But at a private institution, those type of policies will increasingly, I think, exist under a gray cloud of uncertainty and are ripe to be challenged. Well, I want to pivot for just a minute because you mentioned the corporatization issue. And one of the, whether it is a cure or a symptom, I suppose one can debate, one of the phenomena associated with the corporatization of higher education has been the increasing tendency to hire presidents of universities in completely closed proceedings with no public participation whatsoever. It's not at all unusual. We've seen this in the past year in institutions like Washington State University, to name one, that the president is hired in an entirely secretive process where no one but the participants on the committee ever find out who else was considered. There's no assurance that a diverse group of people was considered, and at times you wind up with a president who hasn't even ever visited the campus that he is about to take over. Can you talk a little bit about the AAUP's concerns about the presidential selection process and what you're trying to do about it?
Well, we're quite concerned about it. We believe that these processes need to be open. They need to have the full participation of all the relevant groups on campus, students, staff, alumni, and of course the faculty, who we think have a special role to play, and that all searches should include faculty representatives. Now, sometimes searches, you know, they will have faculty representatives, but they won't be chosen by the faculty, which of course violates the whole definition of the word representative. And even if they are, sometimes those faculty members will be ordered not to speak about the search at all, even in general terms, to their colleagues, which prevents them from getting the kind of feedback from the group they're supposed to represent. Now, we understand that you can't make every aspect of a search open. If you're going to have 100 applicants, you can't tell everybody tell the public, everyone who applied. But we believe that a good search will end up with a small group, 2, 3, 4 of finalists, who should then be, names should be made public, who should be invited to the campus to meet with various constituent groups. And that's of use not only to those groups, but also to the candidates, so they can learn about the campus and see if it is a good fit for them, if it's a kind of place that they think they could make a positive contribution to, just as much as important for the faculty, students, and others to be able to interact with these candidates and see if this is the kind of person that they want to lead the institution. And then people give feedback. Now, this isn't foolproof. At the University of Iowa, for instance, they did a search for a president, and they did follow this because, in fact, it's required by Iowa law. As a subsequent AAUP investigation disclosed, the search was rigged from the beginning, and they immediately handed the job to the candidate who was clear was going to get the job from the beginning. The search was all for show, and three very highly qualified academics who brought to campus under a sham, while a very unqualified, in the view of most faculty members, person from the business world was given the job. And as a result of this investigation, the AAUP has added the University of Iowa to its list of institutions sanctioned for violations of shared governance standards. So we're certainly very concerned with the growing tendency of secrecy. And I want to add one other thing. The administrations often claim they need to be secret because otherwise good candidates will not apply. The interesting thing is they've said this for years in my own old institution, the California State University, where until very recently we did have open searches. And they said, well, we lose good candidates, which is a way of dissing all the people they had hired beforehand as they were apparently not the best candidates. And in fact, some of them were good and some of them weren't. But we see no difference in the quality of candidates that are hired through secret searches or through open searches. In fact, it's arguable that while the qualifications may be the same or even better for someone hired in a secret search, their ability to lead the campus is severely constricted by the secrecy of the search and their need to, from the very beginning, devote their first months just to simply establishing their legitimacy among the various constituent groups on campus, which is not the case, of course, if you've done an open search and gotten input from everybody. Even if people's favorite candidate is not hired, they feel they have been heard and understand the process is legitimate.
Sure, and we should point out, because it's just a little over a year since the explosion at University of Missouri, which led to the toppling both of the president and the chancellor there, that both of those officials were chosen in entirely secretive searches, and University of Missouri, having learned utterly nothing from this experience, has gone back and renewed the same secretive process over again and just filled one of the two positions with someone who was a complete stranger to everyone on the campus. And we saw what happened at Missouri, that as soon as the authority of the president was challenged, and as soon as he got got crossways with his constituency, the bottom fell out because, just as you say, no one was invested in his presidency. No one felt like he was their president. There were no stakeholders. There was no buy-in. And therefore, he went into free fall as soon as his legitimacy in office was questioned. I should also mention that even though we can debate whether quote-unquote good candidates will or would not apply in public processes, I think one thing we can say for certain is that truly terrible candidates will not apply in public processes because they know that their backgrounds will be subject to scrutiny, which is not always the case in private processes. There was a recent study published by George Mason University that showed that these executive headhunting firms who were paid so much money by universities to find these candidates, in fact, almost never do any background checking at all. And so people whose backgrounds will not withstand public scrutiny because of scandal or misconduct or incompetence will do much better in private searches where they're not held up to public scrutiny and where the people at their prior workplaces are not able to wave that red warning flag until it is too late. Just in the couple of minutes that we have left, I want to give you a chance to wrap up, returning to our initial subject about the press freedom climate on campus and the safety both of journalists and of advisors. Where do we go from here? How do we move forward? What might be some of the solutions if we wanted to get the stakeholders together around trying to make a better climate on campus for journalism and for journalists?
Well, that's a very important question, and we in the AUP felt that simply issuing this report was one step forward that we could do, and spreading it around and making people more aware of this issue is an important part of things. You really can't change the atmosphere until you start making people aware of the problem, reminding people of the importance of a free press, something I think will be even more important after January 20th, reminding people of the importance of a free press, or reminding people the importance to quality education of academic freedom and of free expression in general on the campus. So that's the first step, and that's something the AUP has been now doing for over 100 years with varied success. But there are also some concrete steps that need to be taken. I know SPLC has been very much active and involved in promoting various forms of legislation in states that would guarantee student press rights, so-called anti-Hazelwood legislation, which is mainly necessitated by the Hazelwood decisions, restrictions on high school journalists, but it's still, as our report points out, not entirely clear whether college journalists are covered by Hazelwood or not. There's been varied court decisions. So legislations that would protect the independence of student news media and their advisors at both high school and college levels would be a very big step forward, and it's happening in a number of different states. Now, of course, much of that will mainly affect public institutions. The other thing to do is I think we need to promote and encourage faculty members, faculty senates, student government groups to stand up and speak out for this. And some of this is an educational process. I know sometimes we all know that sometimes student media, because it's student media, it's amateurish and they make mistakes sometimes. And that sometimes really irks their fellow students and also often their faculty members who think, oh, we got to bring this under control. I know this happened when I was at my campus. And I think it's very important for us to educate student governments, educate faculty senates and faculty leaders of the fact that students will make mistakes. Professional journalists make mistakes. That is not a justification for undermining the independence of the student media. And I think the key here is really faculty and students understanding their common interests here. Because unfortunately, while I think there are still many administrators who uphold principles of academic freedom, et cetera, there are far too many of them and increasing numbers who seem to say, well, yes, I'm all in favor of free expression, free press and academic freedom. But, and then the but is, of course, the whole core of the issue, that the but sure. can't really undermine the institutions. So we have to really educate people about this. So I think education is one of the biggest things. And then, to my mind, really the unity between students and faculty on this issue is critical.
Yeah. Well, we have to leave it there. And by way of sign-off, I want to give a shout-out for the AAUP's upcoming annual conference in June of 2017 right here in Washington, D.C. You can register online for that at aaup.org. They are marking the anniversary of their 1967 Statement on Student Rights by focusing their annual conference on the rights of students in colleges. We will be there, and we hope you will be too. Hank Reichman from the AAUP's Committee on Academic Freedom and Tenure, thank you so much for joining us, and encourage everybody to visit their website at aaup.org and read that report. Please visit the Student Press Law Center as well online at www.splc.org. Thank you for listening, and we'll talk to you next month.